to the Chord Memory Club, the tune from Hamburg to Leipzig, the Shisoki remix. That's about it for me for today. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. My website is at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine free speech under fire. We'll dig into recent First Amendment cases challenging state laws that are mimicking Donald Trump's attacks on free speech.
Our guest is attorney Robert Kornrevere, chief counsel for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, better known as FIRE.
Then we'll turn to a case you may not know but should. Chambers v. Florida, decided in 1933, laid the groundwork for Miranda rights and other reforms.
Author Richard Brust joins us to talk about his fascinating new book, Chambers v. Florida and the Criminal Justice Revolution.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. The First Amendment is being tested in many arenas, not only in response to various executive orders which Donald Trump has issued in his second term, but also in state legislatures, which are experimenting with how far the government can go in restricting freedom of speech. In Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a Texas law requiring age verification for access to internet porn sites. In 2024, Mississippi enacted House Bill 1126 after a Mississippi teen became the victim of sextortion on Instagram and died by suicide. That law requires young people to obtain their parents' consent before they can create social media accounts. On August 13, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a brief unsigned order allowing that law to go forward despite a lower court injunction. Meanwhile, South Park is savagely ridiculing Donald Trump. CBS capitulated when Trump sued them over a 60 Minutes segment, and a conservative appeals court struck down an injunction on a campus drag show. There's a lot going on when it comes to free speech. To discuss all this and the state of the First Amendment in the United States today, we're very pleased that Robert Kornrevere has joined us again on Law and Disorder. Robert has been a First Amendment litigator for more than four decades. He is chief counsel for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known as FIRE. He is the author of The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder, The First Amendment and the Censor's Dilemma, which explores how free expression became a part of American identity. FIRE filed an amicus brief in support of NetChoice in one of the cases we're discussing today. Bob, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Steve, it's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us more about that Mississippi House Bill 1126 and how it could be used against major social media sites, including Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, X, Reddit, and YouTube.
Well, Steve, as you well know, this is part of a trend among the states to try and regulate various online platforms, and in particular, social media platforms, on the idea that they are harmful to minors' welfare in general. This is a tradition of passing laws to protect minors in many ways in response to moral panics and in ways that are overly broad and destructive of free speech. And it's a tradition that goes back well into the 19th century with regulation of penny dreadfuls and dime novels and you name it. And then regulation against jazz music and rock and roll, video games, violent television. these are the kinds of things that we see come and go. And today's culprit is social media. Basically, states are regulating social media platforms primarily by trying to age gate them, require parental permission before the minors can get accounts, try and screen for harmful material, all of which is an overbroad response to an overblown problem.
Bob, your organization, FIRE, filed an amicus brief in support of NetChoice's challenge to House Bill 1126. NetChoice is a tech industry group that includes social media companies like YouTube and Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, as well as Amazon and Airbnb. What stake does NetChoice have in this legal battle, and why would it seek to strike down a law intended to protect children?
Well, there's no question but that NetChoice and those who are arguing on behalf of NetChoice and in support of NetChoice agree with the overall goal of protecting children, but there is disagreement specifically about what these laws are really designed to do and whether or not they go too far. NetChoice is an industry organization. It represents various media players, including all of the major tech companies and operators of social media platforms and others. And they have been bringing suit in various states as legislatures adopt these kinds of measures. I'm helping the team represent NetChoice in another case, in a challenge to a California law, the Age Appropriate Design Code Act. And there are other challenges around the country to other state laws, like the Mississippi law, that regulate the ages of people who can sign up for social media platforms and what kinds of content they can make available to minors. Now, there is an ongoing debate, and we all recognize the usefulness of having this debate, of whether or not social media is good for us generally, and that includes adults, whether or not it's affected our attention spans and so on, but also a major debate over social media and its implications for mental health and anxiety of young people. What's interesting is that this debate has been flattened out so that the nuance of it has been eliminated when you look at these kinds of legislative proposals. If you look at the advisory that the Surgeon General put out a couple of years ago, for example, it said that social media is also beneficial for young people and that for some young people there may be adverse effects, but it was too soon to tell because the research doesn't answer those questions. A similar advisory was issued by the American Psychological Association, and if you look at the specific studies on which those advisories are based, they also present a very nuanced picture, saying that while it might not be advisable for some people to spend a great amount of time on social media platforms, by and large, they provide as many or more benefits than they do potential detriments. But nonetheless, the legislative response has been to impose a one-size-fits-all solution that is really destructive of the free speech rights, not just of minors, but also of adults.
So U.S. District Judge Hillel Suleiman Ozerden issued an order that temporarily prohibited the state from enforcing these restrictions against several of NetChoice's members. That judge recognized that the state may have a, quote, compelling interest in safeguarding the physical and psychological welfare of minors online, unquote, but he did grant the injunction nonetheless. What was his reasoning, and what evidence did Netflix present in the lower court to support the judge's findings?
NetChoice presented a fairly straightforward First Amendment challenge, saying that when you have this kind of content-based regulation, the burden is on the government, both to demonstrate the law is necessary to serve a compelling interest and that it is using the least restrictive means of doing so. In terms of the compelling interest, the argument is made, and then the judge suggested that the state's one-size-fits-all approach was going too far. But even if you grant the premise, there is a compelling interest in protecting minors, and I think that's something we can pretty much agree on. The problem is the law as it was applied to these social media platforms regulated way too much speech, was vaguely worded, restricted speech that even minors have a right to access, and simply was not calibrated to reach the kind of precision that the First Amendment requires. Rather than use a scalpel to address the problem, the state legislature used an axe.
Bob, but Mississippi went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which in a brief order this July 17 agreed to temporarily pause Osurdin's order while the state appeals. What reasons did the Court of Appeals give for its decision?
Well, in its most recent decision to stay the order, it didn't give reasons, simply stayed the idea that the statute should be enjoined. There was an earlier order from the Fifth Circuit, however, this past April 17th, stayed the earlier injunction that the judge had granted, and did so on basically a procedural ground, saying that based on recent Supreme Court precedent, that the district court should have worked through the analysis of how you examine constitutionality of statutes in a more detailed way. The Supreme Court case called Moody versus NetChoice, another regulation of social media platforms from Florida, in which the Supreme Court laid out the steps.
The Supreme Court upheld a stay of the injunction. In a concurring opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said, Netflix had, quote, demonstrated that it is likely to succeed on the merits, namely that enforcement of the Mississippi law would likely violate its members' First Amendment rights under this court's precedents, unquote. Do you see Kavanaugh as a friend of the First Amendment, and is there any suggestion that on the merits the Supreme Court may uphold NetChoice's claims?
Well, let me take your question about whether I see Justice Kavanaugh as a friend of the First Amendment. I've been watching his career since he was a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and he has certainly issued some notable opinions that are First Amendment friendly. He hasn't been, I would say, necessarily a standout at the Supreme Court in protecting the First Amendment, but the night is young, as they say. But this concurring opinion that he issued was interesting in a number of respects. First of all, when the court issues decisions in its emergency docket, whether or not to stay a decision below before the full appeal comes to the Supreme Court, you don't always see a decision rationale from the court or an explanation of why they've reached that decision. And in this case, all they really did was refuse to undo the stay that the Fifth Circuit had put in place without explanation. But then you have this separate opinion from Justice Kavanaugh in which he does point out quite accurately that in the half dozen or more, and he actually seven other federal district courts, that all of those courts looking at similar laws have issued injunctions under the First Amendment, and that that is an accurate view of First Amendment law as we currently understand it. So what's remarkable about this is that these kinds of concurring opinions in an emergency docket decision are rare, and it's hard to know why Justice Kavanaugh issued this other than to say, if you look at the traditional legal principles under the First Amendment that the district courts have been applying, they are likely correct. The other kind of mysterious part of this opinion is that he goes on to say that when the case is adjudicated on the merits, the First Amendment would likely find this law to be unconstitutional, but that NetChoice had not yet demonstrated that the equities favor granting this relief of undoing the stay of the injunction while the case is going forward. Now, normally in First Amendment cases, the equities are weighed in favor of protecting First Amendment rights. That is, generally it's considered to be any infraction of the First Amendment has a strong presumption against it that there is no equity favoring the government enforcing a law that is likely unconstitutional. And usually that would mean that the law should be put on hold until the state can demonstrate that the law is unconstitutional. But here, the opposite, at least according to Justice Kavanaugh, is being applied, and that is the law is likely unconstitutional in his view, and yet the equities favor allowing the state to enforce it until we see a full decision on the merits. And that gets things backwards.
Bob, following up on that, there's a lot of controversy over this emergency docket, or as it's known as the shadow docket. What do you think is going on here? Because in many cases, and you've said this, they are upholding Trump executive orders, and in this case, a Mississippi law, almost putting the burden on the challengers when maintaining the status quo would go the other way. So are you concerned about any abuse of the shadow docket?
Well, I'm not so sure it's abuse of the shadow docket so much as it is abuse of government power that for those cases that get to the court through the shadow docket, the court has not been quick to delay government action. As you know, the president has been quite active in various areas with his executive orders that have affected everything from higher education to public broadcasting to law firms and so on, and immigration, obviously. And there has been a tremendous amount of litigation, hundreds of cases that have been filed, and some of which the administration has sought emergency relief from the Supreme Court through the shadow docket. In many of those cases, you have the court basically allowing some of those initiatives to go forward in the cases that have reached it on the shadow docket without coming down with a firm rule blocking action. You have one exception where you have the court unanimously saying that for people who are going to be deported, due process does in fact apply. That was welcome. But there are other cases, too, where the court has allowed these actions to take place while the case is being litigated. And so I am concerned that the court has not provided as much check on executive power as I would like to see. But I'm also trying to be patient about how the court finally comes out when it reaches the merits of these decisions. And so, for example, in this latest case involving NetChoice versus Fitch, I'm confident when these cases are ultimately adjudicated that the Supreme Court will reach the right decision and be speech protective, even if I think it is unfortunate that the court didn't apply its usual principle of blocking an unconstitutional act before it gets fully appealed.
Bob, can you please tell us more about the case of Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton? Is this a big deal from a First Amendment perspective? And what does it mean for the various state efforts to regulate minors' access to social media services?
Thanks, Heidi. That's an excellent question, because there's a lot of confusion about the case Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. It is a regulation of online media, but a more focused one. The earlier case we were talking about involved regulation of access to social media in general. Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton involves the regulation of access by minors to pornographic images. Now, in the real world, in the brick-and-mortar world, this is a much easier type of thing to apply. You have a young person walk into a store and want to buy what the Supreme Court has called girly magazines, and the clerk, in a 1968 opinion, the Supreme Court said the clerk can be required to see that person's ID before they can make that magazine available. That's not so controversial in a one-on-one situation like that, but as we've moved into electronic media and the online world, the court over the years, and very consistently over the past 40 years, has said that if you have a blanket restriction like that, while minors can be prevented from perusing a pornographic material, that is material short of obscenity that adults have a right to see. and so you can't impose a burden on adults that affects their ability to review and see these constitutionally protected materials. This kind of flips that on its head and says that this burden can be imposed because even though adults have a right to see this, it's okay for the state to impose something of a burden before they can see it. Now, that is contrary to the usual rule that the government is required to use the least restrictive means of regulating, and if there are other ways to protect minors, and there are, then it's required to use those. Now, this is very different because of the online media. If for things like bookstores or libraries or other kinds of brick-and-mortar establishments, you apply this one-on-one, but in the online environment, basically you have to screen everybody at the door, at the threshold, before they can get access to this. And the other thing that makes it different is that when you screen for age online, you are also screening for identity, and you are very directly infringing people's rights to privacy, which the First Amendment also protects. This is, again, an unfortunate decision, and it is contrary to the trend of Supreme Court decisions in this area. The one kind of limiting principle and saving grace is that the court defined what it means for this material that can be regulated very narrowly. In Justice Thomas's opinion, he said that we're not talking about R-rated movies here or even indecency, which is the kind of thing that the FCC regulates. We're really talking about material that is considered to be obscenity as it relates to minors, and said that it has to be that narrowly applied. Now, why is that important? That's important because in these other state laws that we were talking about earlier, that these regulations are not focused on this kind of material, pornographic material, that is obscene as to minors and can be regulated under that constitutional standard. Those laws apply more generally to all kinds of subject matter that minors have a right to have access to and that do not fall within those very narrow parameters. And some people are reading the Supreme Court's decision on this very limited area as being applicable to all material and all communications that minors have a right to access to. And so saying that minors under 18 can't have a social media account without their parents' permission. And that, at least as I understand First Amendment law, is a violation.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and my co-host is Heidi Boghossian. Today we're speaking with Robert Kornrevere, the chief counsel for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Bob, we're going to check off some other controversial First Amendment issues for the rest of the show, but let me ask you generally, what is your current assessment of the Supreme Court when it comes to the First Amendment?
Well, apart from the disappointments from this term that I've been discussing, overall, the Supreme Court has had a pretty good track record, particularly when it comes to online speech, but on free speech issues in general. Last term was a blockbuster term at the Supreme Court, for example, and the Supreme Court issued a number of opinions, even though it didn't reach the final outcome in a lot of those cases, did articulate a number of very important principles that are being applied in lower courts across the country with all of these various controversies we've been discussing. So I mentioned the Moody case earlier, and that was a key case involving two state laws, a Texas law, another Paxton case, and the Moody case out of Florida, in which state legislatures wanted to regulate how social media platforms moderated, that is, edited the content and applied their terms of service for those who would use them. These were controversies that grew out of decisions by social media platforms to basically deplatform certain people when they violated their terms of service, including the former and now current president. State laws basically put state governments in control of those decisions, saying that they had to live up to the standards that the state expected. And that case was decided different ways by two different courts of appeals and ultimately went to the Supreme Court. And while the Supreme Court sent the case back unanimously, saying that you have to go through a more fine-tooth analysis for how you look at these laws, it did articulate a number of very important principles, among them that the fact that a technology is new does not divest it of First Amendment protection. And it also said that just because we're dealing with social media doesn't mean the First Amendment goes on leave, and more importantly, that it is not the state's obligation to make sure that the level of political discourse is fair according to whatever a given state decides it wants to impose. And so it is reaching a number of very important principles. Another of them last year, in a case involving the National Rifle Association, reached the conclusion that it violates the First Amendment when state actors use their official power to try and force private entities like the National Rifle Association to change their political message. And in this case, the state of New York and its financial services regulators were trying to lean on insurance companies and banks, saying they shouldn't do business with the NRA because they didn't like the organization's political message. And again, the Supreme Court decided unanimously that that was an abuse of state power and a violation of the First Amendment, reaffirming a principle that goes all the way back to 1963, when states were trying to use informal pressure to regulate bookstores to prevent minors from getting access to what they saw as racy literature. Again, the Supreme Court overall has been on target, reaching the right decision in First Amendment cases. But this term hasn't lived up to the standard that we expect when we look at the Free Speech Coalition case, and also the upholding the ban against TikTok, requiring divestiture of TikTok, even though by executive action that ban has not gone into place.
What are the First Amendment implications of CBS settling its case with Trump over 60 Minutes?
Oh, we need a whole program to address all of the implications, because there are a number of moving parts here. You have on one level the Federal Communications Commission using its investigatory power to lean on the network in what I found to be an entirely baseless investigation into 60 Minutes over something called news distortion. It's something I'm pretty familiar with because at one time earlier in my career, I was chief counsel to the chairman of the FCC. And so investigating a news program because you don't like the way it was edited is way beyond the FCC's authority, and it's a violation of the First Amendment. That investigation coincided with a private lawsuit being brought by then-candidate Trump against, or president, it was filed when he was president-elect, against CBS over the same 60 Minutes interview, which, by the way, was just a standard exercise in how news programs are edited all the time. There was nothing to the allegations that for either the private lawsuit or the FCC investigation. But nonetheless, the president filed this lawsuit against CBS in Texas, claiming $10 billion and then later $20 billion because this editing of 60 Minutes was purported to be a violation of Texas deceptive practices law, the kind of law that is applied to, say, a used car salesman turning back the odometer on a car. Completely ridiculous. But nonetheless, CBS chose to settle the Texas litigation for $16 million because they needed to get approval from the Federal Communications Commission for a proposed merger with Skydance Media between Paramount Global, the owner of CBS, and Skydance. And so that political pressure was able to force the settlement of a baseless lawsuit in Texas. Ultimately, a number of ramifications from that, including conditions imposed on CBS to have what they call a news ombudsman, a pledge to provide $16 million in public service announcements, supposedly in favor of causes that the president favors, a number of things like that. The implications of the First Amendment, even though there's no actual court decision to point to, are serious, because if people don't stand up for their First Amendment rights, those rights functionally don't exist. And in this case, CBS thought that its interests were best served by giving in to this kind of pressure. As understandable as that might be, given the kinds of tools that the federal government and the president specifically were able to bring to bear. But nonetheless, the implications are serious in that it shows that that kind of bullying and extortion can be effective.
Bob, how can listeners follow the work of FIRE?
Well, Steve, thanks for asking. We are the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Our website is www.thefire.org. We try and use both litigation to protect First Amendment rights, but also we try to use education and persuasion to support what we call a culture of free expression that goes beyond just the minimum legal requirements for what the First Amendment requires, but also for an open civil society in which open dialogue is used in preference to coercion and force.
Bob, thanks so much for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Steve, thank you, and you too, Heidi. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In 1933, four young black farm workers in Pompano, Florida, were arrested for the murder of a white shopkeeper. With no lawyers and no meaningful due process, they were held for a week, beaten, threatened with lynching, and ultimately forced to sign confessions. Their convictions and death sentences seemed almost certain in the Jim Crow South. But 7 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed those verdicts in a unanimous ruling, declaring that confessions obtained under psychological coercion rendered them involuntary and violating the 14th Amendment. In Chambers v. Florida and the Criminal Justice Revolution, author Richard Brust vividly revisits this often overlooked case. Chambers opened the door to the Warren Court's criminal procedure revolution, laying the foundation for decisions such as Miranda v. Arizona. The book also highlights the lawyers and communities behind the case. Jacksonville attorney Samuel McGill, one of Florida's few black lawyers, kept the appeals alive until the case reached Washington. Richard Brust is a journalist and historian whose work focuses on law, politics, and U.S. history. He was a longtime editor for the American Bar Association's ABA Journal and has written extensively about the courts and the evolution of U.S. legal culture. Rich, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be here.
What first drew you to the story of the Pompano Boys and the case Chambers v. Florida?
It was initially a suggestion from my faculty advisor. She had done some research on the case, but she was distracted from continuing it. And I picked up the opinion that was written by Hugo Black, and I was just struck by it. It was wide-ranging and interesting. It brought in so many issues that were going on at the time, and I thought it was worth more than just an investigation, and I suggested that I actually do my dissertation on it, which is what I did. And the book is an adaptation from that. So it was a really remarkable reading case, and I was just taken by it.
So in light of that, Richard, why do you think it's been overlooked largely compared to the Scottsboro Boys or even a case like Brown versus Mississippi?
I would add one case to that, which I do mention in the book. It's Moore versus Dempsey, which was a case that came out of a race riot and labor dispute in Arkansas in the 1920s. And all three of these cases sort of came at a time when Jim Crow was prevalent, and it was a time that eventually fed into the Great Depression. The cases were similar in that impoverished African Americans were rounded up and prosecuted and denied their fundamental rights. But the three cases, Brown, the Scottsboro case, and Moore versus Dempsey, were nationally known events. And the Scottsboro cases especially were nationally prominent. They were taken over by the National Communist Party and lawyers from the party's legal arm, the International Legal Defense. And they publicized the case all over the place. They held protests. They had rallies. It had a real national presence. And in fact, so many of these other cases, Brown versus Mississippi and Chambers versus Florida, were also called their state's quote-unquote Scottsboro case. So there was an understanding that the fact patterns of all these cases were so familiar. But the thing is that with those other cases, especially Scottsboro, there was so much part of the national conversation that I think what happened was that historians tended to overlook Chambers. And the other reason that historians overlooked it is that the fact pattern for Chambers was fairly typical at the time, which in itself is kind of tragic, really, that poor African Americans were rounded up and prosecuted. So there was no national presence in this case, unlike the other cases, and not too many historians looked into it.
Let's talk about Attorney Samuel McGill. How central was his role in the case, and what does his story reveal about black lawyers in the Jim Crow South?
Well, this was truly one of the most fascinating parts of this investigation that I found. The rise of the African-American lawyer in the early parts of the 20th century showed how lawyers would eventually be able to push the boundaries of civil liberties. Many of the African-American lawyers were primarily private practitioners, and so was Samuel McGill. They did wills, estates, marriage, family affairs, and a lot of them were tied to black fraternal organizations. So they were very financially secure, and they could jump out and take cases like Chambers that were not very monetarily helpful to them. So they were able to jump into these occasional cases when they came on. What it basically did was it showed how lawyers would eventually become involved in all of these civil rights cases that originally came up. When many of us think of civil rights lawyers, we think of the people that came up in the 1940s to the 70s who were associated with the NAACP, and they basically partook of desegregation cases, voting rights cases. But McGill's generation came at an earlier time, and it's very interesting to see how they eventually became pulled into this whole idea of civil rights. And one more thing about that, and I found this very fascinating when I did the investigation of it, is that there were cities like Jacksonville in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that were places that allowed the rise of a black middle class after the Reconstruction era. For those who are historians and like this stuff, C. Van Woodward described this in a very famous book that he wrote, how a lot of places in the post-Reconstruction era were sort of still experimenting with how African Americans and whites would interact. And Jacksonville was one of those cities. And so a whole legal bar grew up in Jacksonville at the end of the Reconstruction and the early 20th century. And what a lot of these African American lawyers did was pull these cases out and plunge into them for years. So they were able to do this both monetarily and by the nature of the area that they were in. So it's just an interesting study that I frankly think deserves a little more attention to this particular generation of African-American lawyers.
Well, Richard, I think we've hit upon your next book, Black Lawyers Before Thurgood Marshall, right?
I certainly won't be the first one to do it, but I think that there's plenty there that hasn't really been investigated yet.
So let's dig a little deeper into the Chambers case itself. Tell listeners more about the tactics and coercion that was used there. Do you see Sheriff Clark as a symbol of lawlessness in that period?
One of the most interesting parts of this whole case, and this is part of history, was the placement of the sheriff, who was a very important figure throughout most of American history. And what I did in the book is go back to the medieval England to show how the idea of the sheriff came about. When the earl of a certain state would leave, he would throw all of his duties onto the sheriff, and the sheriff would be able to do everything, organize a posse, post taxes, prosecute people. So this evolved into a very big, a very important job that was brought over to the colonies when they were first started. So this is a long history of the role of the sheriff as this very, very important figure. One thing that occurred in the United States was that after the Civil War ended, when slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment, I hope I have my amendments right, that what happened was that the sheriff then took the role of what's now known as the enslaver or the slaveholder. This was a very important role. I mean, the slaveholder basically was the guiding figure in Southern life up to this point. The sheriff moved into that role and then sucked in all of the arbitrary power that the slaveholder had. So the placement of the sheriff was very, very important, and it grew particularly in the South because of the replacement of sort of a state-functioned person in charge of this rather than a slaveholder. And all of these prominent sheriffs evolved into these very, very important local figures, both in terms of law enforcement and in terms of politics. Sheriff Clark, who figures prominently in the Chambers case, just took over this role, this very prominent role of being the person in charge of deciding how these impoverished Black Americans, African Americans that he took in, that he prosecuted, what was going to happen to them? Would they be released to the mob? Would they be prosecuted through courts? The sheriff basically could bobble one against the other and assume this role of increasing role of power that he had over the way that litigation took place, over the way that all of these cases took place. Again, it's just a very functional role throughout the South of this period, and indeed in the time of the Chambers case as well.
Interesting, Richard. Can you also touch on how local racial dynamics in the 1930s Florida shaped the case's outcome, actually before it reached Washington?
Right. And this is another thing that I wanted to emphasize in the book. Among the many things I wanted to do was to provide a lot of context for what this case was all about. And one way to understand how this case progressed in Florida, which was a southern state, was to show the racial culture that the state had at the time. The state had a very active Ku Klux Klan that basically took sides with law enforcement. And they were frequently involved in police work of all kinds. So you had this interplay of appointed police and sheriffs who were voted in and local Ku Klux Klan. It was all part of the same infrastructure. The other thing to know about Florida was that it ranked second in the number of lynchings per capita throughout the United States. One of the things I picked up in the book had to do with a lynching that occurred in Broward County, which is where Pompano was. And this took place alongside the appeals process for the Chambers case. So many of the white people in Broward County were angry that the Chambers case had taken so long to progress that they basically, the sheriff arrested this one guy named Reuben Tracy, and rather than prosecute him, they basically arranged a lynching. What I wanted to show was that the sheriff had this arbitrary power, again, as we talked about, to decide which direction he was going to push any of these prosecutions, either to the mob or to the courts. Here they decided to stage a lynching. And many people who were on board at that time said that it's exactly what happened. The sheriff himself basically arranged for this lynching to take place. So you can see how this was all part of the context of Florida as a southern state. What happened in the Chambers case, was that a white businessman was beaten to death in Pompano. And what happened was that the sheriffs rounded up just about every African-American person they could find in the area. This was a prominent agricultural area, so a lot of African-Americans came in as migrant workers. So it was really easy to go into that area and just round up all these people. They finally picked four African-Americans, and they brought them in, the sheriff rather, did brought them in, coerced confessions through the jail. They basically jailed them and coerced confessions that they basically killed this gentleman. The problem, of course, was that the confessions were not voluntarily given, and that was the main issue in the case.
Richard, please talk about Judge Hugo Black's opinion in Chambers. What do you see as the most significant contribution, and how did Black's past in the KKK complicate the significance of him writing such a progressive opinion?
I would say the most important thing that Black did through this opinion was basically to bring in and to basically stress the importance of due process. And, you know, it's funny, I when I teach college students, I occasionally bring up the idea of due process. And for a long time, it was hard for them to understand exactly what that meant. These days, with a lot of things going on culturally, it's a lot easier to explain to them exactly what due process is and what happens when there's a lack of due process. But one of the things that was so interesting to me about the case was Black's background. And he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And he was Franklin Roosevelt's the first person he chose to be on the Supreme Court. A lot of Roosevelt's voters who were African American were very betrayed by this, by the fact that he was a member of the Klan. What Black did was he got on the radio and gave a speech basically saying that he was not a member anymore, and that was sort of ancient history. By the way, it was the second most listened to radio speech after King Edward VIII's abdication speech. But what Black did with his Ku Klux Klan backing is that it allowed him to build his business in the South. And I think it's kind of important for us to understand the time frame here, that belonging to these fraternal organizations was a key element in people building their businesses. And also the Klan was also sort of the underground of the Southern Democratic Party at the time. But what eventually happened after the case came out, it was so highly celebrated by African Americans that they sent letters to Hugo Black telling him how much they appreciated what he did and how difficult it would have been for him to surpass this Ku Klux Klan backing and to come up with this decision that he came up with.
Richard, I found another dynamic in your book so fascinating, which is the international context, which might not ordinarily come to mind. Why was it important to compare Jim Crow policing to European fascism?
Well, this was something that came up in the African-American media organizations and newspapers. For years, when Nazism began to rise in Germany, so many African-American newspapers wrote long editorials about how akin the rise of fascism was to what had gone on with Jim Crow. But this had been mostly within the African-American community. Eventually, after World War II and on into the 1950s, when the communist world became America's enemy, it became understood to most Americans that this was how police states operate. What this revelation meant to a lot of Americans and to the courts was that if we want to distinguish what the Constitution is and what the Constitution does, we have a ready-made enemy, a ready-made that would be able to make the case for how important the Constitution was as opposed to what was going on in Europe and what was going on in the communist world. And that is the rise of the police state and the rise of the totalitarian state. So this was a key in both understanding what Black was thinking of at the time and what the African-American press was finally able to ease into most Americans' way of thinking at the point.
Richard, how did this case connect to the NAACP's broader legal strategy in the 1930s and 40s?
What a lot of lawyers, and McGill especially, did before that era was to basically establish lawyering as a means of pushing along the civil rights ideas and civil liberties ideas.
Do you see the Chambers case as the true beginning of the criminal procedure revolution even before the Warren Court?
What I think the Chambers case did was to basically recognize Hugo Black as one of the key thinkers in the whole idea of the importance of due process and the importance of criminal justice. A lot of the elements that Black began to push in the Chambers case arose in cases down the road that went into these ideas even more thoroughly than Chambers did. And I want to read really briefly one quote from a case that came out 4 years after Chambers called Ashcraft versus Tennessee. The fact patterns are pretty similar. Black wrote this: certain foreign nations convict individuals with testimony obtained by police organizations possessed of an unrestrained power to seize persons suspected of crimes against the state, hold them in secret custody, and wring from them confessions by physical or mental torture. So long as the Constitution remains the basic law of our republic, America will not have that kind of government. And this was 1944. This was like at least a decade before Earl Warren became the Chief Justice and pushed along this criminal procedure revolution. So you can see where all these ideas came and how Hugo Black was able to expand this manner of thinking into the court once Earl Warren took over in the 1950s.
Richard, going back to the case, what were the immediate impacts on the defendants themselves? Were they freed, resentenced, or otherwise affected?
Once the case was decided, that was certainly not enough for the sheriff in Palm Beach and Broward County, Florida. They went back and rearrested all four of the individuals in the Pompano Boys and charged them with the same crime. The case was pushed through, again by McGill jumping in, and he filed a motion in Palm Beach County. And luckily, the Pompano Boys had the luck of having a gentleman named Curtis Chillingworth as the judge at that point. He was one of Florida's best respected judges, and he ruled basically in 1943 that no jury could possibly find in either way for these in this case, and he basically ended the case at that point. Three of the Pompano Boys were released, Walter Woodard, Jack Williamson, and Charlie Davis. Unfortunately, I was not able to find any record of what happened to them after that. I would assume they went back into the migrant stream that came up and down the East Coast at that time, but there's no record of anything that happened to them after that. Unfortunately, Izell Chambers, who was the only one of the Pompano Boys who actually pleaded not guilty, had been sent to a psychiatric hospital while he was stationed at Rayford Prison, which is a state prison in Florida, and he died there in 1954. And that is about as much as I could find of what happened to these men.
If you're just tuning in, this is Heidi Boghossian with my co-host Stephen Brody. We're speaking with Richard Brust, author of a book called Chambers v. Florida and the Criminal Justice Revolution.
Richard, how did the Chambers case and the controversy around it influence later rulings, particularly Miranda versus Arizona?
One thing that the Chambers case basically showed was the importance of Hugo Black's thinking in the criminal procedure revolution and the criminal justice revolution that came later. What happened was that the idea that private citizens had the rights to explain themselves in court when the arm of the state moves in was the most important manner of thinking that came out of both beginning in Chambers and on through the Warren Court. And when you have cases that came out during this period, the 1950s, Miranda versus Arizona was a key case. It basically said not only does the individual have the right to explain himself when he's in court, when the arm of the state has taken him in, but he has the right to know exactly what his options are. And that's basically what Miranda, that's my interpretation rather, of what Miranda basically allowed people to do. It gave them the information that they needed to assert those rights. And one other case that's worth mentioning is Gideon versus Wainwright, in which the Supreme Court said that individuals under arrest for criminal cases had the right to a lawyer, which basically came back and said, not only do you have these rights to explain yourself in court, but you have the right to have somebody who is a professional who will go in on your behalf and explain these things to the court. So I think what Black did and what all these cases that came out of the criminal procedure revolution did was basically show where the hand of the state stopped and where the rights of the individuals came in.
Landmark cases, Richard. We have just a couple of minutes remaining. What lessons from Chambers remain relevant in today's debates about policing and coerced confessions?
Well, this is one of the most important things that I think that this, I hope that this book will be able to bring out. We've talked about due process and how important that is. And we've talked about the problems of a dysfunctional justice system as compared to foreign totalitarian governments. But there's one more point that I want to bring out that I stressed in the end of the book, and that is having faith in judges who understand exactly what Black set out in Chambers. And we see this now, if I can jump into the present time, when a whole lot of cases are coming up through these individual local judges and federal judges on a local level. What's vital is that they are basically doing what Black did. They were basically asserting the rights of the Constitution and the rights that individuals have. Argument of the administration is that these single judges don't have the power to set those rules, but they do have the power to enforce the law and to explain what the Constitution requires. And I think that if we can get anything out of this book, I hope, was the idea of where we stand in terms of the rights of the Constitution and in how these rights came about and the people that were able to make us aware that we have these rights as individuals.
Richard, it's been a true pleasure to discuss your book, Chambers v. Florida and the Criminal Justice Revolution. Thank you for your detailed investigation, your clear writing, and for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Heidi, it's a pleasure to be able to work with you and to see you again. I know we've gone back several years. And Steve, it was very nice to meet you and to interact with you. And thank you both very, very much for inviting me onto the show.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the effort of the Trump administration, largely successful, to take over the opposing institutions in our society, including Columbia University.
Our guest, retired Columbia University professor and author Rashid Khalidi, explains how the university board of directors caved to pressure from the Trump administration.
Then, we'll speak with Brazilian expert, Brown professor James Green, on what the United States is doing to Brazil.
He'll talk about the unraveling of U.S.-Brazil diplomatic relations and how it will impact trade relations, the U.S. economy, and even diplomacy with China. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
V.I. Lenin, the leader of the Russian Revolution, observed that sometimes decades go by without very much happening. and other times, decades happen within weeks. In a sense, we are living through such a time. It is comparable to the great transformation several centuries ago when feudalism was finally subdued and capitalism flowered. The obligations of the master to the serf were severed, and workers were left on their own in the new ruthless capitalist society. The harshness of capitalism was ameliorated by social legislation, most notably by the reforms instituted in the 1930s in the Roosevelt era, when we got Social Security, unemployment compensation, government jobs, workers' injury compensation, and later Medicare and Medicaid and food supplements. These ameliorative measures are now targeted and have been partially taken